About any further ado, I'm going to give you John. I'll get you some water.
John, I'm an alcoholic. Through the mercy of God and the help of a lot of good people, I'm finding it necessary to take a drink for 32 years. I had my last drink of alcohol on January 7th, 1968, in Rosary Hall of St. Vincent's Hospital in downtown Cleveland. No, of myself, I am nothing. Of myself, I am nothing. Everything I have today, everything I hope to have, I owe to the God of my understanding and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all I can tell you tonight is sober is better. For the new men here tonight, sober is better. This is a new way of life. Sober is better. Anything that's ever happened to me since I've been sober has been better. And I've had a lot of rough times sober with my health and a lot of things, but I didn't have to take a drink. Sober is better. And AA teaches a new way of life. I certainly want to congratulate the Ashtabula Harbor Group on their 55th anniversary. And with a little bit of fast arithmetic, I want to... Old man, I wear my glasses. This is 2,860th time that a bunch of drunks got together and said to our Father. How many people said to our Father in the bars? You know, 2,800 times a bunch of drunks got together and say to our Father. And this is really a privilege to be up here tonight and help celebrate the 55th anniversary. You know, a bunch of drunks dedicated itself to start this group and help another drunk. You know, I can't stand up here tonight and tell you anything profound. I can tell you why I'm a drunk. I'm a drunk because I drank alcohol. That's why I'm a drunk. I can't tell you about nothing about all this bullshit I hear up here today about they talk about dysfunctional homes, your inner child or outer child or upper child or all this stuff I hear today. I don't believe none of that. I'm a drunk because I drank. And people will ask, why am I a drunk? Because you drank. Nothing because my mother did, my father did, or my inner child. If I found the inner child, I'd like to finally kick his ass. You know, I hear so much goofy stuff in there, it drives me crazy. You know, I came in there, I'm a drunk. I'm not a drunk in a hand. I'm not a dooley. I'm a drunk. You know, sometimes I hear so much crazy stuff in these AA meetings today, it drives me crazy. I heard a guy stand up here. I didn't understand. I don't understand him. He stood up here and he said, I'm a bonger. What in the hell is a bonger? You know, I found out this bonger is some kind of a pipe you smoke something out of it. That's kind of crazy stuff. One day a guy stood up and said, I did doobies. I said, what the hell kind of a bonger did a doobie come in? You know, I don't understand that kind of stuff. I understand about booze. You know, long ever before I took a drink, my life was unmanageable. I never could manage my life. I grew up in a small town in southwestern Pennsylvania, one of two children with two fine parents. I had good parents. My dad was a hard worker. My dad worked in the coal mine for 50 years. And he drank like a pig. I don't know if he's an alcoholic, but I know he drank like a pig. In this little town where I grew up, this little coal mining town, there was a lot of drunks, a lot of drinking. You know, weddings, funerals, christenings, or whatever, there was drinking, there was drunkenness. You know, and these people, they even drank when somebody died. When I was a kid, that's many, many moons ago, when I was a kid, somebody would die, they'd wake the bodies at home. It'd be like a damn party. People go visit the dead, and they'd be out in the yard shooting crap and drinking and fighting and carrying on. And I see that, and I say, shit, I ain't never going to do that. You know, I'll never be like that. My dad would wake up in the middle of the night and be hollering sometimes. My mother would tell me, your daddy had the snakes last night. What in the hell is a snake? It was nothing more than a DT's. And I often wonder, why would anybody drink that stuff that makes me crazy like that? If that stuff makes me crazy, I'm not going to drink it. You know, but growing up with a kid, I was in trouble. I got into school, I was in trouble in school because my life was run on self-will from a kid. I did things my way. My way would never, never work. I never would pay attention. I never followed the rules. If I would go somewhere and there'd be a sign, don't walk on the grass, the hell would, I'd walk on the grass. Don't sit down in that chair and say, what pain? I'd do it any damn way. I did things my way. No cigarette smoking in school, I defied it. I smoked in school. See what I wanted to do. My way always got me in trouble. My way always got me in trouble. I was always a three-inning ball player as a kid growing up. I never completed anything I ever finished. I get in twos, I go three innings, not quick. You know, I get into high school with all the trouble in high school because of my attitude. I had a bad attitude like I see a lot of these kids today coming in there, got bad attitude. Don't tell me nothing. I know what life's about. I'm 16, I knew everything. I didn't know a damn thing. I couldn't be told nothing. And when I was a freshman in high school, my sister was a senior. And our principal told me one day in high school, he said, "You're a disgrace to the Brinson name. You're a disgrace to the Brinson name." He said, "Your sister-in-law liked you." He said, "You never follow rules. You'll do what you're told to do. If you don't start changing your attitude, kid, you're going to be in trouble. You're going to have a hard time in life." And I laughed at him. You know, my sister went to a reunion, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, whatever, and our principal was there. He asked my sister, "Whatever happened to that brother of yours?" You know what she told him? "Yeah, he'd become a drunk. He'd become a drunk. That's the hell of a thing to talk about your brother. But what else could she tell him? That's what I became, was a drunk. That's what I became, was a drunk." And I got high school in 1957, and my dad, I thought my dad was the terriblest thing in the world. My dad was a hard worker. He believed in work. When I got high school in 57, my old man sent me down to talk to me. He said, "Kid, what do you want to do with your life? Do you want to go to service?" I said, "Hell no." "Do you want to go to trade school?" I said, "Hell no." He said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "Why do you want me to go to work? I went to 12 years of school. I want to take a vacation. I'm going to stay around home here." He said, "They were buying me clothes, buying me cigarettes. And just living like I was giving, I was 6 years old. Why would I want to leave home? That'd be crazy. I don't want to go get no job. I don't want to do nothing." But you know, when I was about 17 out of high school, I was out with a couple of fellows one night, and they had a bottle. And we drank. I drank that stuff just like water. It was nasty, you know, nasty. But I got drunk. You drink enough, you get drunk. And I got drunk that night, and I was sick, you know. And then what I remember that night is these two guys took me home and threw me in the house where I was raised with my mother and my grandmother. And I was so sick. I had a big garbage can in the middle of the kitchen. I was puking. And every time I went over here, my mother and my grandmother would be hitting me with a broom. Boom, 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 boom. Man, I was sick. And I went to bed that night, and I woke up in the morning, and I was sick. But I woke up the next morning. I didn't wake up and say, "I'm an alcoholic. I want another drink." No, no, I earned that right to be an alcoholic. I earned that right. But I'll never drink again. That was in 57. And the old man kept on me, "Go get a job, kid. Grow up, go get a job." You know, and I didn't understand why he was trying to get me out of the house. But he wanted me to go on with life's work. And I'm 6 months of 21. Him and I had an argument one day, and I run away from home. I run away from home at 20 years old. Yeah. In Pennsylvania, they taught us the three R's. Reading, writing, and the road to Cleveland. 1960, I found this road to Cleveland. I came to Cleveland, buddy. I'm scared. I'm alone. Not knowing nobody, you know. What am I going to do? But I got a job. I hunted around. I got a job at a hospital down there on Broadway in Cleveland. I took this job in a hospital, you know, and I hated Cleveland. I hated Cleveland. I had never seen so many buses, so many big buildings, so many people in my life. I tried to cross the street. They had signs on the street, "Walk and don't walk." She didn't even tell you when to walk and don't walk at this time. I didn't know what. Honest to God, I didn't know nothing. The town I came from was about 300 people. Small coal mining town. But anyway, I got a room in a boarding house across from the hospital. And a bunch of guys worked in the hospital, lived in that rooming house. And one spring evening in 1960, I took a walk with these guys up Broadway. We're going to go get some suckers. We took a walk up Broadway, and they stopped in a gin mill. And I had been in the saloon when I was a kid with my dad, but very, very seldom. So I walk in the saloon, and these guys are drinking beer. They're having a good time, you know, and they're shooting pool and talking to the girls. And I'm sitting there back in the corner, very shy, very lonesome, not knowing how to do nothing. But I heard a guy order a fishbowl. And I didn't know what the hell a fishbowl was, but I seen him one of those big schooners of beer. So I drank me two or three of that big schooners of beer, buddy, and I was ready. I was ready. I was shooting pool. I was doing everything I wanted to do before. I couldn't do it. But you know, from then on, from 60 to 68, till I screamed for help, it was drink trouble, drink trouble. I can't stand up every night and tell you I've had any fun drinking. I've never had no fun drinking. If I think for a minute that there's a giggle in a bottle for me, I'm in trouble. No more giggles in the bottle for me. From day one, it was drink trouble, drink trouble, drink trouble. And that's the way it was. In 1960, that year, I met a girl at this hospital. She worked there. And I thought, that'll be my answer. I'm lonesome. I miss Pennsylvania. I miss my friends. I'll get a girlfriend. And I got a girlfriend. And I thought I was in love, but I was in heat. I didn't know the damn difference. I tell it like it is. I'm sorry. That's the way it is for me. I was in heat. And a couple months after I started dating this girl, she came to me and she said, I'm pregnant. You what? How in the hell did you get like that? Playing dumb, you know, playing dumb. I knew, but I was playing dumb. What are we going to do? She asked me that. What do you mean, what are we going to do? You got a mouse in your pocket? What are we going to do? I thought about it for a couple of days, and everybody I knew got women in the family where they got married. I came up with a big idea. We'll get married. Oh, that's a good idea. She was an erotic, and I was drunk, and we're going to put a life together. And I'm about, like I say, a couple months shy of 21, and she's about 19, and we're really screwed up. But we got married, shotgun wedding. And we got married, and we went into housekeeping for ourselves. We had a three-room apartment. And this woman, when I married her, she was a pretty good woman. But after I married her, she turned out to be the devil's daughter. Oh, she was mean. Jeez. I like to stop after work and drink with the guys. I like to go out at night after I come home from work. I don't even nag her. She would nag. Give me the paycheck. She wanted all the money. I said, you want money? Go out and work. Shit. We had this house, you know, and I come home from work and she wanted me to cut the grass. Cut the grass. I never cut grass in my life. I ain't gonna start now. I worked all day and I deserved to go out with the boys. I knew that there was other women out there, other things to do besides being tied down to a wife. She gave birth to our first son in 62. And things didn't get no better because I continued to drink, I continued to do what I wanted to do. And this kid at home and her, I just couldn't stand the pressure. And I kept drinking and drinking. And in the middle of the night, I'd be sleeping, the kid be crying, she'd be telling me to get up at the kid. I said, hell, I worked all day, you get up and take care of me. And that's the way it was. I finally lost this job at the hospital where I worked in 1962. And I took a job where I was presently employed today. Where I retired from, I mean, a couple of years ago. Anyway, it's Christmas time at this shop where I worked. They had a big party. And all I did, I guess, was show off and get drunk. I got drunk as a skunk. And they brought me home. Two guys brought me home from work. And the next thing I can remember, my wife's sitting on the edge of the bed crying. What are you crying about? What's the matter with you? She said, last night, two guys brought you home. They threw you in the house. You fell asleep on the floor. You was broke. No money from payday. It was two or three days before Christmas. It was a mess. And she says, you raised hell. She said, you beat the hell out of me and pushed me around. She was 7 months pregnant. God forgive me. And she told me my son, who was 10 months old, I picked him up in a high chair, threw him in a high chair across the kitchen floor. She said, I went crazy. And I didn't believe her. But she showed me the marks on her and the bruises on the kid. Okay, I'll quit drinking. I'll never do this again. Please, I'll quit drinking. And I quit drinking. But I quit hanging with the guys I hung with. I didn't quit going to the bars. I kept doing what I wanted to do, but I didn't drink. A couple months later, in the spring of that year, we moved to a different neighborhood in Cleveland. And I hadn't had a drink now between Christmas and Easter. And the day after we moved, the landlord came down the bottle. He put it on the table and said, have a drink. I said, I don't drink. My wife said, for God's sake, you had that once this Christmas. Take one. One won't hurt you. But I know that one was the one that lit the fire. And I took the drink, and the drink took me. And from then on, from 63 to 68, it was drink trouble. Second son born in February of 63. My kids are a year apart all but a day. All but a day, they're a year apart. And I'm drinking. And I'm waking up sick in the mornings now, going to work on a bus. And I'd be so sick in the morning. I found out about that morning drink early. I stopped in a saloon and I'd give me a cup of black coffee, and that black coffee wasn't working. And some of the guys I worked with said, kid, that coffee will make you sick. Take some of the hair of the dog. What are you talking about, the hair of the dog? What is that, dog's hair? I didn't know what they were talking about. I thought some people in the city drink dog's hair. What the hell did I know? No. What you drank last night, drink this morning, it's going to make you well. And I start drinking in the morning, I'd get well, the hell with work and hell with everything. And it's the way it was. I kept living like that, drinking, carrying on, not facing my responsibilities, always thinking about me. I was the most selfish bastard ever to walk the face of the earth. I was selfish. And it's one thing I can say today in AA I've learned in these past 32 years, how not to be selfish no more. My wife sometimes thinks I'm selfish, but I'm not a selfish person. You know, I've learned how to give of myself, give to other people. And this is the biggest thing I've learned, one of the biggest things I've learned in AA. In 1966, I came home from work one evening, and I gave her some money out of the paycheck, and I went downtown with a friend of mine. And I come home drunker in hell, and she was and trying to get more money from her, and she wouldn't give me no more money, and I raised hell. And she called the cops, and when the cops was called, I jumped in bed and covered up my head and pretended I was asleep. It was in the middle of February, cold, snowing outside, you know, and I jumped in the bed. And I heard the cop car pull up off court. I looked out the upstairs waiting. Here comes two cops. So, oh, shit, I'm going to jail. And buddy, I jumped out of that bed, put on my pants, no shoes, no socks, no shirt, and I went out the back door. And I heard him telling them two cops, they come to the front door. He went out the back door, and they come around the house, and they're hollering, "Stop, halt, we want to talk to you." Bullshit, I jumped over the neighbor's fence, and up the street I run in a pair of pants in a snowstorm. And I run in the gin mill. I run in the beer joint up the street, and I told the barmaid to hide me. I said, "Please hide me, the law is after me. Wear your clothes, don't ask questions. It's cold outside, go get a coat. Don't ask questions, hide me, please." I said, "I'll tell you about it when the cops go." So this kind woman took me downstairs and locked me in a walk-in cooler. So here I am, locked inside of a walk-in cooler. When I come out of that cooler, I was more sober than I went in, I tell you. But it was cold. And I told her what happened. And I went home that night, and my wife had got the kids back to sleep, and I went to bed that night. And she's telling me, "Go to sleep." She said, "We'll talk about it in the morning." She said, "I'm tired of being a whooping post for you. I'm tired of you abusing these kids, waking these kids up in the middle of the night. I'm tired of begging you to help me support these kids. Just go to bed and we'll talk about it in the morning." I went to bed and I slept. The next morning I woke up and I was sick. And I was hungover and I had that full of remorse and full of guilt. But these two kids running around the house, they were, they were three or four, I think. Mark and Mike and they're telling me, "Daddy, we're going to go move with Grandma. We're going to go live with Grandma. Mommy can't live with you no more. You're bad. You drink. You hit Mommy. We can't live with you no more." And I begged her, "Don't take my boys away from me." It didn't do no good. She had called a cab to take her down to her mother's. And the cab came. And these two little boys, just three and four. And she took these kids, and she went and lived with her mother. I never want to forget it. You know, these two little boys, they loved their daddy as much as they knew how to love at that age. And their daddy loved them as capable of loving somebody. But these two little boys, one on each leg, hollering, "Daddy, we don't want to go. Mommy, don't leave Daddy, please. But Daddy's sick. Daddy won't drink no more, Mommy." But they went. My two boys were innocent victims of my drinking. They were raised in a broken home. No father and a rotting mother and my stepfather. It was sad. But they grew up to be men. They're good men today, in spite of me. And anyway, she told me when she left, I could come get these kids on Sunday morning and bring it to my house and spend Sunday with the kids if I paid her child support. But you know, I drink all week, and I drink on Saturday night, and Sunday morning I woke up, I ain't hungover, and I go to her mother's house to pick up the kids. And I'd take them on a bus. They'd look at me and they'd say, "Daddy, would you buy us breakfast?" "Yeah, Daddy would buy you breakfast." You know where Daddy would take them? Because Daddy was sick. I needed to fix me first. I'd take him in a saloon and put him in a booth. Give him a bag of potato chips and a bottle of Pepsi Cola. It's 9 o'clock on Sunday morning. And Daddy's sitting in that bridge waiting to get well. Man, that was bad. That was bad. And these kids had potato chips and Pepsi Cola on a Sunday morning. And visitation rights was taken away. I don't want to be like that, you know. But every time I took a drink, the drink took me. I thought the answer was in the bottle. And by that time, in my neighborhood up here where I live, there was a lot of old farts like me today, you know. They were the old wine heads, winos. Everybody laughed at them, teased them, derelicts. And these guys, I met these guys, and they introduced to me, which has become my favorite drink. They introduced me to Muscatel, Thunderbird, Wild Irish Rose, Riffle, and Night Train. And I'm here to tell you tonight, if God made anything better than wine, except for yourself, I believe this. I believe this. That Thunderbird wine made you kick your mother-in-law in the ass. That was the best stuff. And I started hanging with these winos, you know. I started hanging with these winos, and these winos were good to me. And I'd work a few days, and I'd go on binges with these winos. We lived in the doorways, in the flops, in the garages. didn't care about nothing. Just cared about what he had next week to spend the time. And these winos, they learned me a lot. They learned me how to panhandle. They put me out on the street. I stand up for a panhandle. It amazes me today when I hear people stand up behind these podiums and talk about, oh, I had $1,000 a day habit. Gee, $1,000 a day habit. It would take me 3 or 4 hours to get 25, 50 cents to get a shorty of wine. And these guys out there were bad winos. Now, they were bad drunks. They were alcoholics. They drank bay rum. They drank aftershave. They drank canned heat. They drank anything with alcohol in it. I ain't that bad. No, I'm not drinking that stuff. And one night we were so sick, all of us. And one guy goes out and gets a loaf of Italian bread and a bottle of black shoe polish. And they was draining this black shoe polish with Italian bread, drinking it. No, no, that's for you guys. That ain't for me. But I tell you what, I did get hooked on. I found out quick that it was good for a hangover. It was cheap and it was easy for me to steal. I got hooked on vanilla extract. I walk around half the time smelling like a damn cake. Yeah. I go to work, and the guy said, Bunza, what kind of cake is it? Yeah, it smells like cake. Yeah. But that stuff was easy to handle. And that don't make me any worse than anybody else or any better than anybody else. So that's where it took me. And I lived with them winos like that for a long time. And I didn't care about my personal hygiene. I didn't care about nothing. All I cared about was as they call it today, party. Today it wasn't no party. It was just a hard time. Because I got hooked on that shit. And I drank that wine without the grapes. That wine I drank, never seen a damn grape. You never seen a grape. It didn't take much for me. It didn't take much. And I lived like that, you know. I wouldn't bath. I wouldn't shave. I wouldn't do nothing. I just lay there and drink with them winos. One night, them winos at dinner, just incidents, you know. It's crazy. We had nothing to drink, and I decided to go steal something. So I went out on the avenue and I stole a bag of onions off of the truck. About a 100-pound bag of onions. And his other wine man, he goes out and steals a box of puppies. And where he gets them, I don't know. And him and I sell the puppies and onions. Trying to get money to get a damn drink. People throwing us out of bars, dead dogs got loose, you know. It was a mess. And I lived like this. And I found myself in 67, November of 67, I found myself strapped to the bed at a hospital in Cleveland. Because I had got sick and the doctor put me in the hospital. And my sister came to my bed, she's hollering at me and screaming, what's the matter with you, why are you living like this, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sick and I don't want to hear her bullshit. Get out of here. So I fought with my sister that November of 67. I said, I'm going to straighten up. I promise you I'll never drink again. I'm going to go to Pennsylvania with her and her husband for Christmas that year. And I went back to work around the first week of November of that year, and I worked, and I had some money. And I promised her that she could pick me up on Christmas Eve and go to Pennsylvania. But I didn't drink all the way up to 2 days before Christmas of 67. 2 days before Christmas of 67, I left that shop where I worked, and I had two paychecks in my pocket, a bonus check they had given us for the paycheck, and they had given us a big ham for Christmas I had in the bag. I came down on the bus. I went to the gin mill. I went in the saloon. And I said, I'm going to call my kids and see if I come see them for Christmas. So I made a phone call to my wife. Can I come see Mark and Mike tomorrow for Christmas? Tonight. That would be like 23rd. If you're sober, you can come see him. You haven't talked to him in 6 months. She put him on the phone. And little Mark and little Mike was ever so happy. Daddy, Daddy, you'll come see us. It's Christmas. What's Santa Claus going to bring us? Well, what do you want? And there was Santa Claus' age. And I told him, I said, I'm going to go on Broadway. I'm going to buy you Christmas gifts, and I'll be there in a couple hours. You wait for Daddy. But your lousy, damn Daddy, come out of that phone booth and sit down at the bar. I hadn't had a drink since November, and this was already December 23rd. And I said at the bar, I'm going to have one shot of whiskey and a bottle of beer, and I'm going to go down and Broadway to buy the kids Christmas presents. I took the drink took me, and I woke up the next morning in that flop house where I lived up there, and I was sick, sorry, and sober. Oh, I was full of remorse and full of guilt. You see, when I was drunk, I had no problems. I had no problems drunk. If I could have stayed drunk, I'd probably still be drunk if I'd been living. My problem was how I found myself that morning, full of remorse and full of guilt. You dirty bastard, you did it again. But anyway, That was Christmas Eve morning of 67. My brother-in-law and sister was going to take me to PA to my mother's house. So I went up to the bar to get a drink. I was sick, man. I needed a drink. I was sick. And my brother-in-law came in that bar and damn near carried me out of there, threw me in a car, and they took me to PA for Christmas. No Christmas presents for my mother, no nothing. Just a dirty, filthy, you know, drunk. And I arrived at my mother's house, Christmas Eve of 67, and I'm a mess. And my wife calling my mother, kids calling grandma, daddy didn't show up last night, grandma, daddy got drunk. Mommy called the bar, daddy was up there drunk, he didn't come see us. Why don't daddy like us, grandma? Why did daddy do this to us, grandma? Grandma didn't have no answer. Their daddy was a drunk, their daddy was an alcoholic, and he didn't know it. See, I took one drink and the drink would take me. I couldn't never quit at once. That insatiable appetite for more than one drink. I take one, I'm gone. I light the fire. The kids, everybody went out the window. But anyway, I made that Christmas day at my mother's house. And that Christmas day of 67, I left my mother's house. And my mother set me down. And with tears in her eyes, she said, Johnny, please go back to Cleveland and straighten up. Grow up, become a man. Grow up, take care of your responsibilities. My old man hollering, please go take care of them boys. Them boys love you. As big as drunk as I am, I never abused you. You always had enough to eat and enough to clothes, and you had a nice Christmas. Go take care of your kids. And I promised them that I would. But my mother gave me a $100 bill. Getting short of breath. Let me get a shot of water. Give me the $100 bill. I come back to Cleveland. I went to the flop house, and I'm crying and wailing and wailing among shit. I want to see them kids. And I went to the phone booth that Christmas night at 67, and I called my wife. I said, please, I said, I'm sorry about 2 nights ago. I said, I got $100. I'll come down and give you half. You buy them Christmas presents tomorrow. She said, you lousy bastard, you. She said, you've heard him for the last time. I want to paint you a picture. She said, 2 nights ago, Mark and Mike waited with their noses at the window. Every bus will come by. Daddy's coming. Daddy's going to come with Santa Claus. Daddy's going to bring us presents, Mommy. Don't put us to bed. 9:30, 10 o'clock, I took that boy to bed kicking and screaming. You didn't show up, you bastard. You was drunk. You'll never see them kids again. You'll never see them kids again. Man. And I'm hollering at her. She's hollering at me. But I threw that telephone down, and I went down. It was cold, and I went down to the gin mill. And I walked in that gin mill, and my wino buddies was in there. They had nowhere to go on Christmas. They had no family. They was in this gin mill, buddy, and I had a $100 bill in my pocket. That's the money I asked in the paycheck and a bonus check. And we started to drink. And the closing time, when a woman called last call, buddy, we were all in there having a party. The last call, I bought them five winos beside myself. I bought all a gallon of Muscatel. And here we go up the street with a gallon of Muscatel in our arms. And we're in the garages up there, carried on, drinking. You know, it's Christmas, having a good time. And got drunk, supposed to work at 26, couldn't work at 26. I'm in and out, and that's when I was introduced to that guy. But at that time of my life, I was introduced to that new wine that came out. They called a night train. And shit, we go on a train ride every night with that night train. We lay up in them garages, doo-doo. And we drink that damn wine like damn fools, you know. And living like that. But it came to the point between Christmas and New Year's, of 67 to 68, it was a mess. I'm in trouble, boy. I haven't worked. I'm getting sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker. I lost all bodily function. You know, when I come in this program, I heard about spiritual experiences. I'm going to tell you something. One of the biggest spiritual experiences I ever had was when I had my first solid bowel movement. I'm telling you, that's not nice, but it's the truth. It's the damn truth. You drink that wine, you have solid bowel movement. And I lay in that mess for a week at a time, urinate all over myself, get sick and puke. I'm here to tell you tonight, I believe this. If anybody here tonight is thinking about going back, I'll tell you what you do. If you're going sick enough this time, go back out and drink some wine. Drink Muscatel and drink beer behind it. And you'll get so damn sick for about a week. But don't eat nothing. Eat a bag of chips or a bottle of one of them blind robins or a pickled egg. And you get so damn sick you'll lay on your back and you'll puke straight up in the air. I don't understand it. Well, that wine would make me so sick. But it, like I said, with New Year's, going into New Year's, it must have been New Year's Eve, I found myself in the avenues up there. Six, I woke up, and I heard a jukebox playing, Auld Lang Syne. And a woman had me by the head of the hair. And I was sitting with my face in a plate of sauerkraut in the bar. And she said, Happy New Year. Happy New Year. And boom. Back down I went. Back down I went. And New Year's Day, I'm drinking in the bars. I'm in and out, you know. But come the day of January 3rd, 1968, the day I never want to forget. It's the day I must never forget. That power come into my life. That power come into my life. I call out that desperate prayer that every drunk callers. God help me. God help me. I'm in the saloons on the 3rd. You can't come in here, John. You owe us money. You're bothering your customers. I walk out to another one the same way. Get out of here. Get out of here. But that night, I come out of the saloon about 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the 3rd. And never forget it. And I'm lonesome, buddy. I'm scared. I'm crying. It's cold. I got dirty work uniform on. The pants full of mess. Nothing to drink. Shaking. I shake so bad from that damn shake. The stranger come by in the car and blow the horn and wave at me. And I had them damn wine sores on my feet and on my hands. And I'd be so damn sick. And I had a loneliness that only an alcoholic understands. That hopelessness. Hopelessness I had that night. I come out of that bar and I sit up against the window and I'm crying. What am I going to do now? What am I going to do now? Boy, I was so scared. And I walked and I cried and I looked. I couldn't find nothing to drink. I couldn't find a wino. And I'm walking, I'm so lonesome, crying, so lonesome, so scared to death, a fierce. You see, a drink wasn't doing for me what it used to do, but I was scared. Anyway, I went around the block, and I went to the flop house where I lived. And I went to that bed. I laid in that bed, I said, maybe I'll sleep. And I was asleep, I'd jump up, and I thought it would be 3 hours, it would be 20 minutes. But my mind would tell me, John, go to the bathroom, you got to go pee. Hey, John, go, pee. But John didn't have enough strength to get out of that bed to go pee. And I'd roll over and urinate in the bed. And I'd puke. And I'd be gagging. I'd be so sick. But that morning of the 4th, never want to forget it, right here in front of my face, buddy. I've had other illnesses sober. Strokes, heart attacks, sugar diabetes, everything. I'd never been as sick as I'd been that morning. Never. But January the 4th, 1968. I'm in that flop house, buddy, and I'm sick. And I found myself in the bathroom of that flop house. And I'm gagging. I got my head in that toilet bowl, buddy. I'm puking. The nostrils running, the eyeballs are popping. I'm gagging. And god-awful dry heaves. I don't know if anybody here ever had that god-awful dry heaves. Man, I'd be so sick. Nothing to drink. I drink water, and at the past, I drink water, I'm puking. But I found myself in that flop house, in that bathroom, by that sink, and there was a medicine cabinet. And I looked up there, and there was a bottle of alcohol and aftershave. And you don't have to drink aftershave to come here. But I had to do that. And I took that bottle of aftershave, you know, and I popped the lid off that aftershave, and I chug-a-lugged it. And I threw a glass of water behind it, and I burped that shit for a week, the aftershave. But, you know, it's settled me down a little bit. But I went out of that house, that flop house that morning, and I went to the saloon. And I told the barmaid, I said, please, I said, give me a glass of muscatel. I just drank a bottle of aftershave. I'm sick. You did what? I told her. So this kind woman, I was shaking so bad. This kind woman came over and poured a big glass of mustard and gave it to me on the table. And her and I were the only ones in the bar. And I'm shaking. She turned her head while I drank it. I drank about half of it, I guess. Still the rest. But anyway, I went in the bathroom in this saloon that day. And all of a sudden, buddy, the pain's in my belly. I didn't know whether to stand up or sit down. It was coming out of both ends. That aftershave with that muscatel. Man, I was sick. And I come out of that bathroom, she heard me carry on, and she said, come out of there. I went out. But she said, I know a place for people like you. She said, you're an alcoholic. And they got a place called Rosary Hall, downtown Cleveland. And if you go there, they'll give you free whiskey for 3 days. I said, what? Free whiskey for 3 days? Shit, yeah, take me down there. No, you got to call up AA. You got to call up AA. What is AA? I didn't know what AA was. She told me a little bit. And I called up downtown office in Cleveland, January the 4th of 1968. And the first voice I heard was an old man, an old Mexican guy, Dick Perez. And he said, what can I do for you? What can I do for you? I said, hospital, free drinks for 3 days. I want to go to the hospital, but they give you free whiskey for 3 days. He said, no. He said, are you an alcoholic? I don't know what the hell I am. said, I want to go to the hospital and get free drinks for 3 days. And he told me, he said, please, he said, go home and I'm going to send somebody out to see you. I don't know who he's going to send me or what. But I hung up the phone. I went out to that flop house and I waited and nobody came. And I went back to another saloon. And I'm sitting there that day. I'm sitting there sick, nothing to drink, sick as a dog. And I told you in the beginning of my talk tonight, of myself I am nothing. Of myself I am nothing. In that saloon that day walks a man whom I know today was sent by God. I believe this. You see, my mother wore out probably 4 or 5 meters praying for this clown. And people in this room before me was praying for the drunk. And their prayers was answered, buddy, because I wasn't capable of doing nothing. Nothing that I did that I deserved it. If I got what I deserved, I'd be hanging from the nearest oak tree. This I believe. But that man walked up 3 weeks to 3 weeks. Hell yeah, I'll go down there. But he made a phone call, and he called down Rosie Hall. He called my shop first where I worked. I had to work for a week. The boss said, tell him to go. When he's here, he's a good worker. He's not here half the time. When he's here, he's raising hell, causing trouble. He said, tell him to go get out. And he called Rosie Hall in January of 68. And thank God for Rosie Hall in January of 68. They didn't have to interview me. They didn't have to assess me. They didn't have to ask me all these questions about dysfunctional homes and all this bullshit. If he's a drunk, bring him down. Okay, he got me a room. I made one phone call. My last hope that I would have to go to that place. I called my mother in Pennsylvania. I tried to act straight. My mother could tell I was drunk on the telephone. Or half drunk or whatever. I said, please, they want to send me to a place where they help drunks. So she says, go, go, go. I said, no, I don't want to go. I said, send me $100 and I won't have to go. I said, I promise you, if you send me $100, I'll get another room. I'll go back to work. I'll never drink again. And my mother did the best thing she could do for me. At the time, I hated her. No more money for you, sonny boy. You've used it for the last time. You've used it for the last time. She's crying. Please go there and get help. No more money for you. I can't give you no more money. Thank God my mother did that day. I thought it was cruel, but I know today was the best thing that ever happened to me. And I slammed the phone down and told this guy to take me to Rosary Hall. He took me to Rosary Hall, and I went in there on January the 4th, 1968, more dead than alive. I went in there with a pan full of mess, dirty. I weighed 103 pounds, shaking like a leaf, sick as a dog, and I don't know what I was getting into. I was scared to death. But I walked in there and I met some kind people. They put me to bed, they cleaned me up a little bit, you know, and they gave me some pajamas to put on. They were 10 times too big, but anyway, I put them on. And I'm waiting in that bed, I'm laying there sick as a dog. This nurse came, big nurse. In Rosary Hall, all these nurses, when I was there, was like Amazon. Oh, they were big. They were bouncing these men around like rag dolls, you know. Smoking cigars, blowing cigars, smoking your face, all that bullshit. And this kind woman, she was talking to me, taking my blood pressure and all this bullshit. And finally she said, I got a shot for you. And I got on one elbow in that bed, and I reached over to get that shot. I thought she had a shot of whiskey for me. She said, drop your drawers. I dropped my drawers, buddy, she hit me in the ass with a big needle. Boom. Then she gave me that big double header, as I know today was Cobb's Creek whiskey. Wow, what good stuff. Well, so you had Cobb's Creek, didn't you? That was some good stuff. Good stuff. And then she gave me a big glass of orange juice. This is orange juice with Cairo syrup. Yeah. I said, I can't drink that bullshit. I'd make you sick, syrup and orange juice together. You drank the aftershave this morning, you told me, drink it. She was big. Yes, ma'am. And I drunk it down, you know. And there was something else must have been in there, knocked my ass out. I went to sleep and I woke up again and medicated it. But the next morning I woke up again. The next morning, on the 5th, I woke up in that place called Rosary Hall. I'm scared to death. Another big giant of a woman. Like, she's like Amazon. I'm telling you, it was a big woman. They had more muscles than Superman. They were sitting there, you know, she's holding my hand, this nurse. I look at her, and she's putting salve on my hands. They were broke out and sore from when I had been on the cold from that one drink of wine. And I started to cry. What are you crying about? I said, I'm sorry. She said, you've been sorry all your life. Yes, ma'am. I said, look what I did last night. I rolled over and I wet the bed about 4 or 5 times that night. She said, don't be ashamed of that. She said, you're an alcoholic. And she said, I'm an alcoholic. I used to do that. She said, I understand. For the first time, somebody understood. One drunk to another. I understand. She was there. And she rang a bell, and here comes two clowns in hospital. They were patients. I don't know what that they were. And they had badges on. And one says mirror, and one says shirt. Where the hell am I at? But she told these two guys to throw me in the shower. So these two guys took me up, threw me in the shower, and cleaned me up. When I came back to that bed, this kind woman medicated me again and tried to give me something to eat. I went to sleep. But that day, that same day in Rosary Hall, around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, again, a man walks in my room, great big guy. Everybody in that place is giant, I thought. And I'm a midget or something. They were big. This guy walks in the room, he had a carton of cigarettes under his arm. He holds up on my bed. He said, this is for you. I didn't even know the guy. My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to be your sponsor. Do you understand? I said, what? Get the hell sick, man. Don't bother me. I don't even know you. You're bringing me a carton of cigarettes. You're going to be my damn sponsor. What's a sponsor? And he started telling me his story about what drinking did to him and how he got there 12 years before that. And sister called to be my sponsor. I didn't know. And I'm hollering at him, get out of here. He said, bullshit. He jumped up off the chair. He was sitting there. He leaned over the road and started thumping me in the chest. You will listen to me. You understand, punk? Now shut up and listen. When I'm done talking, you talk. Oh, shit, this guy was big. And I had no cigarettes. They would give me free whiskey. There's no one outside. I better listen to these people. Man, I'm scared. And thank God for Rosary Hall in 1968. Thank God for Rosary Hall in 1968. Thank God they didn't have 55 doors with counseling on it. Thank God they didn't talk about this dysfunctional home within their child bullshit. They didn't have swimming pool and horseback riding and all this fancy shit that they got today. They had drunks come to see you. Drunks like I was. And they were talking about being Dooley and Hooley and all this stuff today. They were drunks. And I had some of the best drunks I ever met in my life come to my bed at Rosary Hall. Some of the first 150 guys today came to my bed in Rosary Hall and talked to me. I didn't know them from Adam. Here's a quarter, here's a half a dollar, here's a pack of cigarettes. We'll see when you get out. Hang in, you're going to be all right. And some of these guys, they were old, old. They was not really God say this. They was old, they farted dust. Man, they're old. I'm a young kid, I'm about 28, you know, and I'm scared. These guys left an impression on me. And one old timer come in here like I am, say, Doc, he had a cane. He come shuffling in there. What's the matter, you kid? Is your shoes too tight? What the hell are you talking about? What the hell did I ain't know? And one guy came there the last day I was there. One guy come there and said, kid, we're going to send you for further education. We're going to send you to Harvard for treatment. Harvard, yeah. Broadway and Harvard. I Broadway and Harvard had a club up there, you know, on Broadway in Cleveland. Broadway and Harvard. And that's where they go send me for treatment. I know what they're talking about. But I left there. I left Rosary Hall, people. And I left there with a little bit of hope, a little bit. I was clean. I was sober. I wasn't sick no more. And I met a nice bunch of guys that were going to show me. And my sponsor and another guy came and took me out of that Rosary Hall that night. And at the elevator door, it says, take hope all you leave here. I went into Rosary Hall hopeless and helpless. 103 pounds of clothes on my back. I didn't know nothing from nothing. But I had a little bit of hope with my newfound friends. They took me to my first meeting, which was the Ramona group, which I'm a member today. They took me downstairs in this Ramona group. A bunch of old pot-bellied, cigar-smoking old men. I was 28. That was young. Old men. My age, I think anywhere from 60 to 70 years old. And they were shaking my hand and asking me, I want a cup of coffee and a donut. Shit, I wanted a pint of wine and a hooker. A cup of coffee and a damn donut. I think they were talking. And one guy stood up there and tried to, he was talking like I'm rambling tonight. And he's talking stuff, you know. And after the meeting, one of these clowns come up to me and tried to hug me. He said, I'm going to love you till you can love yourself. I said, get your damn queer hands off me. And he's loving me. What I know, what the men I hung with, these winos, they didn't hug each other. And he's trying to hug me. He's going to love me till I can love myself. Scared me to death. Scared me to death. But these guys, after the meeting, these guys took me, and they sent me down, they talked to me, they tried to talk to me the best they could. We're here to help you. Let us help you. Let us help you. We want to help you. Let us. You don't have to live like that no more. And they took me back to the flop house where I lived that night, and I went back to work the next day. They kept insisting they're going to send me to Harvard. You got to go to Harvard, learn how to stay sober. What now? Harvard. Broadway and Harvard. So they gave me the address, and I went up to this place called Broadway and Harvard. It was a little AA club up there, a dry club. And I walked in, and it was Dodge waiting room. All these old fights up there, old men, They're all the ready to die, like I am today. Oh. And they shuffling around there, you know. One guy said, I'll buy you a cup of coffee. I don't need to call you for nickel. Coffee with nickel cup in them days. And it's not what these guys told me, it's what they showed me. Take our hand and follow us, and you're going to be all right. The biggest thing they learned me was the simplicity of AA. Keep it simple. Dr. Bob said it loud and clear his last talk. Keep it simple. Don't allow the other 30 and complexes. And most of all, keep the intelligent mind out of it. And I say, keep the professional mind out of it. Keep the professional mind out of it. Don't figure nothing out. Don't figure nothing out. 1969, I was over 18 months. I had the privilege to go to New York City with these people. Took me to New York City. And I got to hear and talk to Bill Wilson. You know. And I was very, very fortunate. You know, and Bill Wilson, he always said, keep the professional mind out of it. Keep the professional mind out of it. Don't figure nothing out. Don't figure nothing out. 1969, I was over 18 months. I had the privilege to go to New York City with these people. Took me to New York City. And I got to hear and talk to Bill Wilson. You know. And I was very, very fortunate. You know, and Bill Wilson, he knew how excited I was. I'm 29 years old, and he seen how excited I was. He said, kids, I'm going to tell you something. He said, keep this simple, boy. He says, pass it on. That's all you got to do. One drunk to another. Do for somebody else what these guys did for you. Don't complicate nothing. Don't figure nothing out. It was good enough for Bill Wilson. It's been good enough for me for 32 years. Don't drink. Go to meetings. Your life's about to change. You know, and they told me what I had to do in the beginning. Get a home group. Get a sponsor. They told me about these four absolutes. And everywhere they went, they took me with them. Banquets, dinners, anniversaries. They were good to me. They did everything for me. They know I didn't have no money. I didn't work. And I wasn't able to pay. I wasn't able to do nothing. But these guys, they buy me tickets for different occasions, and they were good to me. And they take me out to eat every night, these guys. The different guys take me out to eat every night. And you know where they take me to eat? They go on the bulletin board and look at where all those eating meetings were in Cleveland. In Cleveland, a lot of, like, they had anniversaries here tonight. And that's why I lived off of that for a year. You know, my wife, I'm sober now 3 or 4 months, and my wife found out that I was sober. She found out where I was hanging out at. And she called that club up there. An old timer named Gus got on the phone and talked to her. I committed that night. He said, I understand you don't pay child support. Now, who told you? Your ex-wife called here hunting you tonight. You don't pay child support. You're no damn good. You're a damn belly robber, he said. He said, you must start paying for your kids. So what? Somebody else down the lane with her, I'm going to pay for my kids? No way. No way. He said, if you don't start paying child support and do decent things, I don't want you here. Get out of here. We don't want you here. Hey, for good people. We're going to learn you how to do decent things. You never was decent since them kids were born. Gus says, when you get paid? I said, tomorrow night. Bring me your paycheck. What? Me for you, Mike? But yeah, if you want to come back, and bring me your paycheck. I took Gus my paycheck the next night like a little boy. And Gus said, now what do you owe out of there? I got to pay $12 a week for rent at that time, sleeping room. I said, I got to buy cigarettes. He said, how much are cigarettes? At that time, what, 20 cents, 25 cents a pack? He said, you don't need TaylorMade. He told me a carton of Bugler. He said, Bugler is good enough for you. You don't need TaylorMade. He said, now here, call your wife and tell her to come up here and get this money. I said, for what? Do what I said or don't come back. And where do you cash that check at? Oh, I cash it in a saloon. I run in real quick and come back out. That thing costs me. It's called a bank. Bring me a check next week. I'll take you and show you how to cash a check. Got took me by the hair like a little boy, took me in the bank, and the bank was full of people on Friday night, and he hollered across the bank to the teller. Cash his kid's check. He's all right. He's one of them new junks across the street. He's all right. And bring me the money. Oh, shit. And I did what I was told. I don't know why I did what I was told to do. And they told me they had to clean me up. And by that time, I was cleaned up. I had new clothes. My mother gave us new clothes. I was able to take a shower, you know, and God said, you're filthy. I said, what do you mean I'm filthy? I'm taking a day to clean you up. Don't ask questions. Either you go, either do what I tell you to do, or don't bother coming back here. Get in the damn car. I got in the car, and Gus took me out, got me a bike seat, took me on Cleveland on the west side, took me back in the woods, and I seen the Big Stein retreat house. What in the hell am I going in here for? We're going to clean you up, boy. You're dirty. What do you mean I'm dirty? Go ahead and see that priest. I went in, and I told the priest, I'm here, I don't know what they want. They want you to clean me up. I'm clean. The priest laughed. He told me to sit down. And the priest told me three easy things. Three easy things I never forgot. First, you got to find God, you got to clean house and help others. I found God through the people of AA, cleaning house and getting rid of the garbage, doing a fourth and fifth steps on further retreat, and helping others. Do for them what he's done for me. This is what I've been trying to do for the past 32 years. Help others. They made me get active early, you know. Thank God for these old timers. How long that time? They got me active early. They told me to get a home group. I joined my home group, which was Ramona group. My sponsor was secretary. But he moved, you know. And these guys were grooming me. He moved. And these two old folks, they told me one day, we want you to be secretary of Ramona group till we get somebody. We know you don't know much about it. But go up and make the coffee and open the doors up and you be secretary. Okay. We'll send somebody up in a couple of months. 17 years later, they still hadn't found nobody. They wanted to see if I'd become responsible. They made me responsible. Can you imagine a guy like me, undependable, unreliable, every Monday night for 17 years being the same place at the same time? And they told me to go visit the hospitals. I went to visit the hospitals, a little nursing home. I just tried to do do for them what was done for me. I found this the new way of life. They learned me how to grow up. They learned me how to behave myself. And that's what it's all about. They didn't confuse me with all this bullshit I hear today. And they didn't take no guff. You do it our way or no way. Our way or hit the highway. You ask us for help. Today, they want to be bathed in coke. These guys didn't coax me. They didn't either do it or you don't. You should have got off the pot. Plain as that. I'm sorry. And this is what I did. And I like this new way of life. And I know it's only from this power greater than myself. And things begin to happen in my life. Things turned around. You know, just because you're sober don't mean things will go well every day. I'm sober 6-7 years. The woman that I loved the most, the woman I hurt the most, my mother. God loved my mother. I was able to make direct amends to my mother. Direct amends. Living amends. When my mother died, my mother was living under my sister with a terminal illness. And through God's mercy and help, a lot of good people, I was at my mother's house every day. And my sister's house with my mother. And I'm sitting there with her, reading to her, helping her eat, talking to her, becoming friends with her. When my mother died, she was screaming, "Johnny, help me, help me." She had so much pain, there was nothing I could do. She said, "She has a disease, and I have a disease. They give me the 12 steps and the 4 absolutes, and don't drink and go to meetings." I couldn't do nothing for my mother. And when she died, she told me 2 days before she died. She said, I don't want to go. She said, "I know I'm gone. Who's going to take care of you?" She said, "I know you've been doing good, and you have these people in your life." And thank God, when she was dying, I said, "Go ahead and go, Mom. Go, go." It was hard. It was a bitch. But to stand there and watch my mother die. But thank God I was there. I wasn't in some flop house, some building, some garage to come get me out of. I was able to be there. I was able to make arrangements to take her body back to PA and bury her. To be accountable for the first time in my life. To be accountable. 1976, I thought I was restored to sanity. The other time I wasn't, I remarried. And things didn't work out. You know, we went, she was in a program, she wasn't, she went, she didn't go. And our life was pretty good. I was able to buy a house, but things got worse, and we grew apart and stayed together. And in 1976, I was 35 years old. I had my first heart attack at 36 years old. And at 36 years old, I was admitted to charity hospital. And they told me they'd have to do a triple bypass surgery on me. Scared the living hell out of me. I'm sober 7 years. I'm 36 years old. They're going to operate on my heart. And these old timers, and one guy in particular named Dick Poutney, he came to my bed. I said, "Dick, I'm so scared." "Why me? I'm sober 7 years." "Why not you? It's your turn. Shut up." "Why not? It's your turn. Except the things you can't change. You said that's ready to occur a million times. But saying it and doing it are two different things." And these guys helped me through it. And I got through that hard 30 years flying colors. 1985, I had another bad heart attack. And in 1985, the doctors told me after that last heart attack, he set me down. He said, "I got some bad news for you, John." And I thought, "What the hell? You got a heart surgery?" He said, "You'll never be able to work again." So I'm 45 years old. I said, "What?" He said, "You'll never be able to work again." The shit, what's so bad about that? I worked 22 years in the shop after I sobered up, and I was able to apply an overseas disability. God's been good to me, and I get disability today. Father in the theater, but my health hasn't been bad. You know, but all of the way I live, the way I carry on, I can't expect that's what else. You pay a price, I believe this. But through God's grace and the help of a lot of good people, I've been able to overcome this. 1985, this marriage was 10 years and down the drain. She got a divorce and it was bitter. And I hated her, you know, but we're good friends today, but I hated her. And you know, when God closes one door, then we got another. 1985, I didn't drink. I kept going to meetings. I did what I had to do. And my wife was today told my life in 1990. Carol here. So Carol chased me down Fleet Avenue with the lasso because she caught me. Now we met in our club. And Carol and I started a date or whatever. And we're married today. We have a good life together. So we bought a home together. She's got two daughters. She's got three grandchildren. I got them two boys. Three grandchildren. It's a good life today. But God has been good to us. Carol and I have been able to share our aid together today. Our home is open. Our life is open book. We try to help drunks. But sometimes it gets hairy. You know, sometimes that whining woman, Carol, sponsors, she's on my nerves. I have no patience. They'll call her and whine. I got a toothache. Go to dentist. I don't want to. But I'm damn sucker. Well, I'm not going to tell you. I know damn dentist. Carol ain't no damn dentist. And you talk about, they're sober for a while. Well, we're maintaining heroin. Like, well, I don't know about no damn heroin. Go to a junkie. What do I know about heroin? You're a winehead. I can talk to you. I never maintained. I never took a wine and went to a meeting and then said I was sober. Where in the hell are you fooling? Hey, it's complete abstinence. You don't drink nothing. You don't shoot it, whatever it is, all this stuff. I don't ever do this bullshit today. I think it's funny, you know. They bonging and banging, smoking, snorting. If you're going to go back out, get a damn bottle of wine, like I said, get good and drunk. Get good and drunk. And I believe that AA can't be all things to all people. AA can't be all things to all people. We got to be single for purpose. One drunk, helping another. And you know, about 3 weeks ago, I was in a hospital for about 3 days. And God's been good to me. I had a stroke here about 5-6 years ago. And I got sugar. But that's, I don't cry about it. What the hell? It's the deal of the cards. And that stroke, you know, got a good therapy, and I was able to maintain a little bit with the cane. And 3 weeks ago, I woke up, I couldn't breathe. Oh, I was gasping for air. And my honey, I called her at work, and she came, and she took me to the hospital, and I was having congestive heart failure. I was filling up with fluid. And they did what they had to do. They gave me pills, make you pee, and I pee like a racehorse. Get rid of that water. So that's the price I got to pay. And I got a bad valve, they told me, in my heart. And they should operate, they said, it's too risky. And I'm blocked up again. I need some more bypasses. But the risk will outweigh the benefit. But God will take care of me, I believe this. If I sit out tonight and die in this chair after I get done meeting, I'll pay for everything I got in AA. AA's been good to me. AA will be good for all of you if you let us be good to it. The better way of life, you don't have to live drunk no more. And all I have to do is don't drink, go to me, and help another drunk. And I think when I die, when I go to meet my maker, he's not going to ask me, how much money did you have, John? What kind of big car did you drive? What kind of big house did you have? He's going to ask me, did you feed my sheep? And I hope I can say, yay, Lord, I fed your sheep, so that's my bun. Can you pray the Lord's prayer now?
Yes, thank you. Stay around the table.